welcome to the Buyer Insights Podcast, a show about how and why people make decisions to buy or run away scared. My name's Liston Witherell. I'm your host. I'm also the CEO of GoodFunnel. You can find us on the web at goodfunnel.co. That's goodfunnel.co. Today I'm here with Jeff Gotthelf, who's the author of Lean UX and the upcoming book Sense and Respond. He's also a speaker and organizational designer. In over 20 years in digital products and services, Jeff has worked to bring a customer-centric, evidence-based approach to product strategy, design, and leadership. And I'm not kidding. This guy has worked with some big names, and he's spoken all over the world. He is an absolute expert in lean, particularly for UX and product development. So I'm excited to bring this conversation to you today about how to really focus on this idea of customer-centric and evidence-based approaches to getting to better products and services. So without further ado, here's my conversation with Jeff. Thanks for being here. It's Liston here with the Buyer Insights Podcast, and I am here with Jeff. Jeff, how are you doing today?
Doing great, Liston. Thanks for having me.
Fantastic. And I should have asked you this in the pre-interview, but can you say your last name so I don't get it wrong, please?
Sure. It's Gotthelf, like it's two different words, and as opposed to Gothelf, which I don't recommend Googling.
Well, now you know everybody's going to do that.
Right,
so
right. It goes Jeff, downhill pretty quickly.
So I'm here with Jeff Gotthelf, and Jeff is an expert in UX and lean UX in particular. And if you could just take a second to tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got to where you are.
Sure. So I started my career as a broke musician, as most people do. And as I got tired of being broke, the internet was coming of age. And so I began building websites for my band and other bands and fell into the first.com world in front-end development, which essentially was HTML at the time, so perhaps that's an exaggeration to call it development, but front-end development and graphic design roles at kind of the dawn of the internet. And that led to ongoing roles in information architecture and user experience design and interaction design. And that was kind of the first 10 years of my career, kind of going into leadership roles, design team leadership roles, and building practices within companies, both big companies, small companies, consulting companies. In about 10 years into my career, I started to shift towards thinking a bit more holistically about product, and then had the opportunity to start to build a team of designers and really with a close set of colleagues in product management in an organization that was transforming from a very strict waterfall process to a much more agile process. And in learning how to do that, I began to publish our successes and our failures in blog posts and in articles and in conference talks and meetups and that type of thing. And that led to a fascinating conversation about design in an agile world, which led to writing a book called Lean UX, which fundamentally changed what I do for a living. For a long time, I was doing design work for a living, designing products, designing services, digital experiences. And in the last 5 years or so, the launch of Lean UX has transformed the conversation that I'm having from, can you help us design this product, to, can you help us design our teams? Can you help us design our process? Can you help us figure out how to integrate product design and the customer into the way that we're building products today? And so I spend most of my time these days consulting with companies, training companies and teams, running workshops and speaking at conferences about how to build a customer-centric, evidence-based product development process that weighs design very heavily, but really takes into account engineering, product management, business needs, as well as the needs of the customer.
Perfect. Yeah. You know, I was looking at your blog, and one thing that really stood out to me was one of your lines on a recent post where you say, rewarding on-time delivery simply guarantees customers get to use the wrong solution sooner. What do you mean by this?
So this is a classic MO for most companies. The way most folks have been trained to manage companies is in an industrial manufacturing mindset. In other words, we've got to make stuff, and we got to make it fast, and we got to make it cheap, and we got to hit our deadlines. And while that's true when you're making physical products, when you're making software, simply getting the thing out the door doesn't guarantee that it's the right thing for the customer, that solves their problem in a meaningful way that they value, and therefore doesn't guarantee that it's good for our business. And in fact, in most cases, because it's software, because it's complex, because it's unpredictable, we're wrong. Our first attempts at solving a problem, designing a feature, launching an app are usually wrong. And so updating it and iterating and optimizing it is a key part of building successful digital products and services. And so if you're optimizing simply for the shipping of features, in other words, let's get these things out the door as quickly and as efficiently as possible, then all you're guaranteeing is that you're getting your first attempt out in front of your customers. And in most cases, the first attempt is wrong. And so that's what I mean by that. And it's a significant mindset shift for companies and for managers and for teams to start to think about their products in an iterative way as opposed to an incremental way.
And so when you say people have the tendency to do it wrong when they're thinking about just on-time delivery and doing it fast and getting it out the door, what do you mean by wrong? Do you mean that it's not quite connecting with the customer or the target persona that they're after?
The customers that use your products have a goal in sight. They have a reason for seeking out the service that you provide, and they're trying to solve a problem. Now, in most cases, they've already got a solution to this problem today. They're just looking for a better way to do it, or a more efficient way, or a faster way, or a more fun way, a more delightful way. When I say you're the wrong thing, what I mean by that is our initial attempts to figure out more compelling, more interesting ways, more successful ways for customers to solve whatever it is that we're helping them solve are not usually going to be the best way for them to do that. And because we work in software, we have an opportunity to build a continuously improving set of products that are based on understanding what our customers are trying to do, how well our initial attempts are actually meeting their needs, and then iterating on our ideas quickly and continuously. And so what I mean by wrong is it's suboptimal. It's less than ideal. It's not better than the competition. It's incomplete. It's difficult to use. It's poorly designed. The copy's bad. I mean, there's so many ways that it could be wrong. It's not like we intentionally ship broken stuff. It's just that simply optimizing for getting it out the door and then never going back to fix it increases the likelihood that we've got something broken out live in front of our customers not meeting their needs.
So one thing you're describing is the lean methodology. You've written a book called Lean UX, which borrows from, or not borrows, but I should say builds upon some of the writings of, say, Steve Blank, The Four Steps to the Epiphany, Eric Ries, Lean Startup. For those who aren't familiar, can you take a second to describe the Lean methodology?
Sure. Lean Startup, the way that Blank and Ries and others talk about it, takes an evidence-based approach to finding the right problem to solve and the right solution to solve that problem. And the amazing thing about this too, which I love, and man, so many UX people were pissed off when Lean Startup came out and got so popular, is that it takes a customer-centric approach to determining what is valid and what is invalid. And essentially what those guys said in their books and in their writings and their talks is this: you are working in an environment of extreme uncertainty, and you want to make sure that you use your limited resources in the most effective way in that environment. And so your goal is to reduce the risk of building and designing things that people don't want. And to understand where those risks are, you run experiments. Now, those experiments seek to deliver evidence to validate or invalidate hypotheses that you have about your product, your service, your market. And so you have a sense of, you say, look, I think there's a need in the market for this type of service, and I think that if we solved it in this particular way, we could make we could build a successful company or a product or a service, right? So there's a lot of hypotheses baked into there. Lean Startup says, let's run a bunch of experiments against those hypotheses. And then let's understand, based on the feedback from those experiments, the evidence about whether or not we should pursue in this direction, whether we should pivot and try a different direction, or whether this idea is dead on arrival and we shouldn't even pursue it any further. And the goal is to spend as little energy, time, money, resources, whatever it is, on these experiments to learn whatever it is you're trying to learn. So that's kind of where the lean aspect of it comes from.
So this whole idea of learning from our customer base, customer-centric approach is what you described. We really believe in that, but just to look at it from maybe a slightly different perspective, you often hear a lot of entrepreneurs saying, you know, what you really need is an opinion that's counter to whatever is the status quo, right? So some people may look at lean and say, well, if you asked your customers what they want in their house, they would say a better fan, not an air conditioner.
Right.
Or they would say a faster horse and buggy, not a car.
Yeah.
So how do you kind of balance this need to innovate and break trends and go outside of what's the status quo today versus still being able to talk to your customers and either validate or invalidate hypotheses?
Yeah. So this is the key to practicing successful hypothesis-driven product development and design or lean startup. The key is to understand what it is you need to know and how to get the answers to that question. And that is really where I think a lot of entrepreneurs, lean startup practitioners fall down, right? And this is really where the UX people really get pissed off, because they're like, we've been doing research for 40 years, right? We can do this. We know how to teach. We can teach you how to do this. We know how to make this successful. And that's the key. The key is to understand what's the most important thing that you need to learn first. And then what's the least amount of work that you need to do to get that nugget of evidence or that learning. And generally, especially at the onset of these types of initiatives and projects, it's how to have that conversation with your customers to identify is the problem real? Do they value it? And that's the key. The key here is not to say, would you like a car, right? Or would you like an air conditioner? The key is to understand, is there a real problem to solve here, right? Tell me about the last time it was hot. What was it like in your house, right? Oh, it was brutal. It was sweaty in there. The fan was struggling. Oh, really? The fan was struggling. Why was the fan struggling? Well, the fan was struggling because we only have one in the house, and it sits in one room, and it blows hot air in from the outside, right? And so, you know, understanding how to ask questions to identify the root cause of the problem. One of the most famous tactics in lean is the five whys. Ask why five times to get to the root of the problem. And that's essentially what you want to do. You want to get people to tell you stories about a specific scenario that you're trying to solve. And then once you start to ask people the same kinds of questions about the same types of situations, you will start to see patterns in their answers. You will start to identify where there's a need and where there isn't a need. And that, to me, is when the fun part of product design and development kicks in. This is where creativity kicks in. This is why we get hired to do the work that we do. Because now you've got evidence that says, here's a problem, here's why it's a problem, here's how often it's a problem, and here's how people are currently dealing with that. And now you have to then summon all of your creativity and abilities to then say, here is a new way, a better way, an innovative way of solving for this, and then running a new batch of experiments to test whether that way actually does solve this in a way that customers would value, would pay for, and would displace whatever the incumbent solution is that they have for that. And so to sum up that very long answer, it's you got to ask questions the right way. And then once you collect good evidence, that's you know, it's up to you then to be creative about solutions. And right, and that's where Steve Jobs shined, right? That's where Elon Musk shines, right? They're not they're not inventing things that didn't exist before they came around, right? There were MP3 players before Steve Jobs. There were cars before Elon Musk. But what they're identifying are root issues and then taking audacious steps to solving those problems in a new way.
Yeah, so this whole process of talking to customers and getting information out of them, you know, I'm really curious to hear your opinion. I think I know already, but what would a questioning strategy be for you? Because I notice when I work with clients in my business and say I'm getting an interview script back from them from a time that they talk to a customer, they ask a lot of leading questions that sort of presuppose some sort of important assumption that may or may not be true. So what is a questioning strategy you think will lead to the most and best information?
Yeah. Your goal is to get people to tell you stories. You want to hear their stories. So first of all, you want one-on-one interviews, no focus groups. Focus groups are the F word of user research. We don't use them. We want to talk to people one-on-one, and we want to understand that person's story. Now, the thing that you want to avoid is you want to get people to avoid speculating about the future, right? Would you like this feature? In the future, would you do X, right? Because we always make the best possible decisions in the future, right? We never make mistakes. We always make the right decisions. We always make the right choices. So your goal is to get people to tell you stories about the way that they behaved in recent memory. That's the goal. So the questioning strategy is, tell me about the last time you bought a car. And then they'll start to tell you about, well, I went to the dealership, I did some online research, and then I went to the dealership and I had to sit there for 2 hours waiting for the sales guy to hand me over to the finance guy, right? And so all of a sudden you're getting a story and you're getting a sense of what was good about that story and that experience and what was bad. Now, if you want to start to get a sense of whether your solution has value, you could say, well, if, you know, in that scenario where you're sitting at the car dealership, if you didn't have to wait for the finance guy, but instead you could come into the dealership pre-approved for a loan, you know, if you had that feature, what would it let you do? So that's the second line of questioning. So the first line is to get them to tell you a story, and then if you can identify pain points and you can say, okay, in a situation like this, if you had this particular feature or this particular service, what would that let you do? And then to get them to see how they would apply something like that in a realistic situation. And those are two of my favorite questions to ask. It's always about, tell me about a recent time that you did something. And then they'll say, they might even suggest something. They'll say, you know what, if I could come into the dealership pre-approved for a loan, that would be great. And you'd be like, okay, if you had that, what would that let you do? Well, I could come in, I know exactly which cars I can afford. I wouldn't waste my time on the Corvette because I know there's no way I'm going to be able to afford it. Right. So all of a sudden, you're getting realistic feedback in a realistic scenario instead of a speculative one in the future.
Very interesting and very valuable. One thing I noticed on your website is that your most shared article is Lean UX for Enterprise. Mm-hmm. Maybe you do know that or you don't know that, but it, by far, it's like five times shared, more than the next best or next most shared article. What is it about enterprise and really large teams that makes Lean especially difficult to implement?
There's no material. There's no material for Lean at scale. At the moment, I mean, I'm talking about lean startup now. Obviously, we've got lean manufacturing, but we're not talking about factories, right? We're talking about scaling, continuous learning, continuous improvement, evidence-based decision-making, hypothesis-driven design and development into a large company. When you've got tens of thousands of employees, there's simply no content on this. If you read Lean Startup, he dabbles into Intuit as a case study here and there. But really, up until some of the kind of the more recent work that Eric's done with the Leader's Guide to Lean Startup, there's really been no content to it. And most folks, most organizations have a difficult time taking these practices and scaling it up from one team to five teams to 50 to hundreds of teams. There's all kinds of challenges to this. There's people management challenges. There's knowledge management challenges. There are incentive structures that get in the way of doing this at scale. As you mentioned at the beginning of the conversation, most companies incentivize for throughput, for velocity, for shipping. They don't incentivize for learning or for pivoting or for changing course. And so if you're not incentivized to learn, you're not going to do that work. And so that's another big issue at companies. And so there are a myriad of pain points where organizations struggle to do this at scale, and they typically boil down to cultural issues, incentive issues, performance management issues, right? So I do my annual review. And if we talk a lot about team-based collaboration in Lean Startup and in Lean UX and in Agile, but if your performance management system at work rewards individual contributors, heroes, then you're not going to optimize for team-based collaboration. You're going to optimize for your own success, and everybody else's be damned, right? Because I want to get my bonus. I want to get my promotion. And so there's all kinds of reasons, right? Distributed teams, different time zones, offshoring. These are all issues that break down the kind of collaboration and evidence-based decision-making process that Lean Startup and Lean UX promote.
So one example that really stood out to me in your Lean UX book, and I wish I could have read Sense and Respond, but it's not available yet, so January is when to check for that. But one example that stood out to me was the PayPal example. And so PayPal was trying to optimize their shopping cart and checkout experience. They were the incumbent, so they'd been doing it for years and years. They had years of financial regulations kind of baked into that whole process. So it felt like an insurmountable task, but one that needed to be done. They consciously decided to limit the team to only 8 people, which got me thinking, do larger teams tend to focus on their own opinions and kind of the groupthink rather than gathering facts from customers and doing this rigor of hypothesis testing?
No, I don't think so. I think the challenge with larger teams is that they're less efficient and they are more difficult to manage, and there ends up being a heavier dependency on formal process in larger teams simply because they are more difficult to manage. And so as you shrink the size of the team down, the transparency increases, successful communication increases, accountability increases, because there's nowhere to hide, right? If you're the designer on an 8-person team and you don't do your work, no one else is doing it, right? There's no one picking up your slack, and so there's nowhere to hide. And so and with less people to talk to, there's less people to manage, there's less people to motivate, there are less people to consult, less people to make decisions, right? So everything just simply moves faster with smaller teams. And that was the key, too, for PayPal. Like they were working in massive teams, broadly distributed around the world, and struggling to bring any kind of efficiency into their product development and design process, because everything that somebody did had to go through the rest of the team, and the rest of the team could have literally been distributed across 5 different time zones, some as distant as 12 or 15 hours away. And so you're looking at 24 to 36 hours turnaround time for any decision, and it's no wonder they weren't making any real progress on any of these projects. And so for them, it was a clear pain point and one that they needed to attempt to remedy with very drastic action. And it was those pilot efforts, those initial efforts that were protected by executives, sponsored and protected by people who could say, look, take 8 weeks, sit together, work together, solve this, don't work on anything else, everybody in the same place, that helped them realize that there are huge benefits to rethinking about how they organize around the work that they have to get done with the people that they have in the locations that they have.
Perfect. So I mentioned that you've written a new book, Sense and Respond, and I was hoping you could, I'm setting you up for a softball here. I'm hoping you could talk a little bit about that and what you saw as the need to write that book and how that's going to help people implement Lean for themselves.
Yeah. So we wrote Lean UX. It's been out for nearly 4 years. In fact, the second edition comes out this month. In the years since the book has been out, in the years since I've been having the Lean UX conversation in public, we've gotten a lot of feedback about the process, about the ideas. One of the main threads, in fact, the most popular thread of feedback, if I rolled everything up into kind of main themes, was at the team level, people get it. They want to work this way. They want to design products this way. They want to collaborate this way. But their companies, their organizations won't allow them to work this way. They simply say, look, I can't, my boss won't let me do this kind of work. I have to optimize for delivery. I've got to support 10 different engineering teams. I don't have any time to work this way. And so Josh Seiden and I, my co-author on Lean UX and my co-author on Sense and Respond, we decided to write a book for the managers, for the people who manage and employ the folks who would like to work in a Lean UX type of way. And so we wrote Sense and Respond for those managers. And Sense and Respond really has two theses in it that we try to make to the readers. The first thesis is this. Regardless of what business you're in, if you seek to scale in the 21st century, you're in the software business first. And so the first half of the book makes a strong case for, it doesn't matter what you actually sell or what you make, you are in the software business first. That's the reality of 21st century business. And we've got case studies from agriculture and insurance and the automotive space and all kinds of industries to prove out that regardless of what you make, at the core of everything that you do is software. The second half of the book is about, look, a software-based business has to be managed differently than a traditional business. There is a level of complexity and uncertainty that you need to embrace. There's a different kind of staffing model that you need to embrace. There's an incentive structure and a cultural model that you need to embrace that allows people to learn continuously, to make mistakes, small mistakes, and then to use those learnings to get better and to iterate on these products. And so the book really takes a management level look at how to run teams, how to run departments, business units, companies differently in a software-driven world.
Excellent. It sounds like there's a huge need for it. So I know a lot of people are going to get a lot out of that book. So now, Jeff, we've come to the time where I ask all of my guests the same three questions, and I think I know what you're going to say. But the first question is, what is the biggest mistake people make in learning about their customers?
The biggest mistake people make in learning about their customers is assuming that their customers are just like them. That's been the mistake that I've seen repeatedly over and over and over again. People assume that, especially if they make consumer products, that they know exactly what the problem is to be solved because I have this problem and everybody thinks like me, and therefore if I solve it for myself, it'll work for everybody else out there. And so they don't actually, because of that, they don't actually do any learning from their customers, or they find people just like themselves to corroborate their thinking. And so that to me is the biggest mistake, is assuming that your audience is just like you and has the same types of needs and pain points that you do. Therefore, you don't even need to really validate whether or not these customers exist and have real pain points.
So with that in mind, what is the one thing that everyone listening to this can do today to learn more about their buyers?
I'm going to answer this question with an anecdote, if you don't mind. Because
I don't mind at all.
Because I could say talk to your customers. But it feels really generic and unhelpful. So let me share with you a little anecdote. 2 years ago, I was invited by Samsung to go to Korea and give a talk around customer centricity, design, user experience. I spent an hour in front of a room of engineers that work on Samsung's smart TV product. So these guys make television. Okay, the most ubiquitous appliance in the world, probably, right? Maybe the smartphone has taken over at this point. I don't know. But certainly for the last 60 years or so, the most ubiquitous piece the ubiquitous appliance in people's homes. And so I spent an hour giving a talk on customers, talking to customers, interviewing customers, understanding what your customers need. And I stop and I finish my talk and I say, any questions? And a hand goes up in the room, and one of the engineers, I turn to her and I say, yes. And she says, where do we find customers? and I was in awe. I was one of those questions where I was literally, and you hear how much I can talk, right? I was left speechless by this question, because these people make television. Like, they make literally the most ubiquitous appliance in the world, certainly for the last 60 years. And I was in shock. My answer to her was like, look, I own a TV. You can talk to me. Every person you pass on the every person you pass on the street on your way home from work today owns a TV. Go talk to them, right? Like, there's that's the thing, right? So I think the most important thing that you can do to understand who your customers are is to make the effort to find them and spend time with them. And it's really obvious as to where they are. And there's so much cheap, free, lightweight work that you can do, or lightweight efforts that you can put in to find those customers. I'll tell you one more quick anecdote, because again, I really want to be more just a bit more tactical about this than talk to your customers. I used to work with this really excellent engineer, and he and I were working on a project for small businesses. And every day on his commute from Jersey City to New York City, he'd walk past nail salons, laundromats, delis, right? Those types of small businesses that we were building the products for. And so on his way into work, he'd pop in to his local neighborhood deli, his local neighborhood laundromat, and ask them just a couple of questions. Hey, how do you guys do online advertising? Do you do any online advertising? And every day he would ask whatever we were working on for the product during that particular week, he'd simply pop in for 5 minutes on the way home or on the way into work to these folks just to get some kind of real-world feedback on the work that we were doing. And so my answer really is, your customers are everywhere. And if they're not, go to where they are and just casually, on a regular basis, maintain continuous conversations with them. These don't have to be lengthy or scripted or very official conversations. Informal, regular conversation keeps you at the edge of what's important to the people that you're helping.
Right. And I think for a lot of people too, a key piece of advice is to stretch themselves a little bit, get out of your comfort zone if you're not quite comfortable with it. It's not as bad as you think.
That's right. That's right. And you get better at it the more that you do it.
Sure. So, Jeff, what is the one book besides your own that we've already recommended that you would recommend to listeners?
The book that I've read recently that I think is fundamental for teams and managers to read is Creativity Inc., the Pixar book, by Ed Catmull's Pixar book. It is a case study in humility, in collaboration, in creativity, in management. There are so many inspirational tactics in there for teams to try, for managers to think about, that I found it tremendously valuable in thinking about the way that I work with my team. So Creativity Inc. for sure.
Great recommendation. I haven't read that one, so I'll have to put it on my list. Well, Jeff, thank you so much for being on the podcast. I'm sure our listeners have gotten a lot out of it. I know I have. Before we go, though, can you tell everybody where they can find you and how to get in touch with you?
Sure. Best way to find me is on Twitter, which is jboogie, J-B-O-O-G-I-E, which is a lesson in, get in early, don't believe the service is going to survive, and then get stuck with a handle for 10 years. But Twitter's really good. You can get to my website at jeffgotthealth.com, or you can email me at jeff@gotthealth.co.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much, Jeff. I really appreciate you being here. And to anybody listening to this, please do reach out to Jeff. He means it. So thank you again, Jeff.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for having me listening.